Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the August 19th regular meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. I wondered if you'd please stand with me while we pledge allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Clerk will call the roll, please.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
I'm here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera has asked to be excused. Ms. Kiefer? Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne? Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Robison?
Here.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
13 members present.
Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
I'm not aware of the need for an executive session tonight. Jonathan, are you?
No need.
I think we could go right into privilege of the floor for the public. And this is the opportunity for anyone to speak to the legislature. In order to do that, it's important that you sign a blue card at the front of the in the back of the room here. We have a couple of blue cards. If anyone else wants to speak that hasn't signed one, please do that and hand it up. You're our guests for privilege of the floor, and we ask you to agree when you sign the blue card to the following. You agree to a 3-minute time limit. You agree not to raise your voice. You agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language, or speak or act in a manner that would intend to incite a breach of peace. You agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, you agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor. And you agree that if you cause a disruption and are asked to leave, you will leave the chambers. I would point out to everyone that we have exits to the back of the room on my right, to the front of the room on my left. And if you haven't already done so, please silence your electronic devices. Peter?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. I'd like to call on Sherry Corthus, please.
Hi, I'm Sherry Corthus, and Corthus. I think it's Corthus. Yeah, I'm still confused on how to say it. But anyways,
I apologize if I don't get it right.
I've spoken out against the jail expansion. I actually came tonight to hear the task force and their presentation. But I'd still like to, hope that you guys are still not haven't final approved this expansion, because I really don't think crime is our issue. I think it's more of poverty, the economic, environment, just everything's not very good. We know what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, and since I come from Columbia, Missouri, it's sort of close to my heart. And I don't think a jail is the answer, because I think a lot of the problems are drug-related with this heroin that they're having. So an example, last night across the street from my home, a couple nights ago across the street from my home on Alvin and Esty, a man was passed out in a yard. And I didn't want to call the police because I didn't want him arrested. We went over and observed him, and he was breathing, and so I knew not to touch him because I have CPR training, and if they're breathing, you don't touch them. So I called the ambulance directly, and they came. But then shortly after that, like not very long at all, two police officers and then one on a bike came. So they had three police officers, and the ambulance people were able to revive him. But then the police officers actually tried to arrest him in that state. And so we watched, my neighbor and I, just to make sure. And they did a fine job. But, again, it was, I thought he should go to the hospital first, maybe. And then, but I see a bad problem with the, I know heroin's a big problem. But I really don't think jail is the answer. I'm going to say again, I think it's rehab. And if we could do something that way, I think we would be and try and love one another and put ourselves in their positions. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Eric Lerner.
Hello.
Former member of this, then called the Tompkins County Board of Representatives.
Indeed.
Welcome, Eric.
I'm Eric Lerner. I live at 504 South Plain Street. Once upon a time, I was a member of this body. More recently, I was a member of the Alternatives to Jail Task Force that will be delivering its official report tonight. But I'm speaking tonight on behalf of myself and not on behalf of the task force. I do support the recommendations of the task force wholeheartedly. They don't go as far as I wish in some respects, but they're all important steps in the right direction, and I hope you will take whatever measures are necessary to implement them in some reasonable time frame. But I also want to say this. I'd like you to join me in kind of a thought experiment and imagine that what we were trying to do was design an institution to create criminals. How would we go about that? Perverse, but how would we go about that if we wanted to? We would want to take young men who already have behavioral issues and difficulty controlling their impulses. We'd want to do everything we can to undermine their self-esteem. We'd want to do everything we can to make their lives as stressful as we possibly can. If a young man has an employer, we want to make sure that he loses that job. If he has a girlfriend, we want to make sure, as best we can, that they break up. If he has family and friends who are not involved in a criminal lifestyle, we want to do everything we can to make sure that they're as inaccessible as possible. And then we want to take that person and lock him in a room with other people who have the same behavioral issues and different expertise so that they can swap skills and swap pointers and make new partnerships for future experiments in crime. It might not surprise you to discover that what I'm describing is the county jail. County jails as an institution are destructive. Every time we put a member of this community, especially young men, into that jail, we are making them, on the average, over the long run, more dangerous. Every time we can prevent someone from going to jail, even when they are involved with a criminal case and criminal charges, we are making the community safer. Everything we can do to keep people out of the jail keeps us all safer. I hope you remember that as you're thinking through the issues around alternatives to jail. Thank you.
Thank you, Eric. That was the last blue card I had. So we'll move on to, I don't see any municipal officials, I don't think, for that part of the privilege of the floor. So we'll move right on to legislators. I'm going to call on Brian Robinson first.
Thanks, Mike. I just wanted to thank everybody, and especially members of the county staff, that came out to Groton last Saturday for Old Home Days. It's always a real nice event for those of us that live there. But it is nice, and I did receive several comments after the parade that members of the Tompkins County government did take the time to come all the way up to Groton to be part of that. So thank you. And I did get never mind. We'll forget about that. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Brian. It was a very nice event, as always, is out there for Old Home Day in Groton. Someone else want to speak? Martha Robertson.
Yeah, Eric, I appreciate what you've said. I heard a story on the radio, I think it was yesterday, about San Antonio, Texas, putting a lot of money into training officers to be able to almost be mental health counselors, and so that when they encounter somebody who's often would just be arrested for disorderly conduct or sleeping on the street or clearly mental health issues or drug issues, that they have ways of really talking one-to-one, understanding. I mean, they had a whole conversation on tape with the person who was hallucinating, and the officer did you just sort of see the way he was able to draw the person out and get that person more connected to reality, and then brought them to a facility, a special county facility, that was a mental health clinic, basically, but residential, so that people could be helped instead of incarcerated. And I would love to find out more about that. And it really obviously had a completely different model and from what we're used to. And as was said before, I mean, drug issues seem to be getting worse and worse. So, maybe that's something that we really need to examine on a long-term basis.
Leslie Bean Claiborne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and everyone else who spoke about jail issues. I would remiss if I don't take the time to just mention, as we all know, what has been happening in St. Louis, Missouri. One of the fortunate things about being in this community is that, you know, we've had our share of incidents happen in this community involving law enforcement and members of the community. But we are a brilliant, relatively tolerant community of individuals who do not resort to the kind of violence and unfortunate incidences that are happening in Missouri right now. I'm thankful to our community for that, and I do want to publicly say thank you to them, because there's so many things that can happen here. But this community and some of the leaders in this community, to whom I'm also thankful, take the time to help people to process, to help people to calm down, so that we don't have that sort of stuff happening here. We do want to make sure that there's accountability, that things aren't swept under the rug. We do want to make sure that due process happens. We do want to make sure that everyone gets a fair hearing and the facts of whatever the situation is comes out and is known. We recently had, and it's in our news, so I'm not saying anything that's not in the news, an incident involving law enforcement and two young black youth in our community, which for many of us is troubling on all ends, for law enforcement as well as for our community's youth and our families. So I continue to reach out and ask everyone in this community to let's rally around working together amicably with law enforcement, as opposed to engaging in the kinds of behaviors that will bring harm to our community. We do want to reach out to our law enforcement and say, be mindful, even more so given what's happening nationally. We're not immune to that, and it has an impact on our own community. But be extra mindful in how you do your job. Many of them do already. There are some of them who are family members of mine, and I do respect the work that they do. But one has to be sometimes super mindful and take that little extra step to recognize that sometimes what is happening nationally on a much bigger scale reflects on a smaller scale, but it's happening. So to all of us, there are things happening in our community. We want to make sure that people are held accountable. We want to make sure that our voices are not silent when we have these things happen. So let's not try to silence people, but try to get them to talk through the issues in a way that's productive. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie. Anyone else like to speak? Julie Kiefer.
On quite a different subject, I received an email today sharing information that a lawsuit has been filed concerning the language that the Board of Elections adopted about the redistricting in New York State. It's a ballot issue for this fall.
And you're talking about the State Board of Elections?
Yes, the State Board of Elections. One of the plaintiffs is an attorney who lives in our county, and Common Cause is part of that suit, as are some other plaintiffs. And it seems to me extremely important that the ballot language be clearer than it is, better than it is. But I mention this tonight because it may be that we will be asked about the ballot issues that are in addition to just voting for people. And as legislators, we have to be prepared to answer those questions. I wanted to ask our county attorney whether or not this suit is timely, and could we actually expect some clearer language to result? Do you have an opinion, Jonathan?
I'm glad I don't represent the State Board of Elections. But, no, I mean, that just happened today. I really haven't had a chance to review it at all. And I can get back on it, but I really couldn't comment on it yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Dooley. Anyone else? All right. We're pleased tonight to have a presentation with respect to the Jail Alternatives Task Force. It was issued a report. I'd like to call the co-chairs, Deborah Dietrich, another former member of the county legislature, then the Board of Representatives, and Susie Cook to do that. And we will suspend for just a moment while we put down the screens. Welcome to Susie and Deb, and please, the floor is yours.
You want to jump right in, Susie? We'll just start. First of all, thank you for the opportunity to present this to the full legislature. The task force met for over 5 months. We met 9 times. We had 12 members of the task force, and it was an exhaustive evaluation and review of how things actually work locally, from arrest through sentencing. And then we started to focus. The latter half of our work was really on what could we tangibly come up with to suggest in both the short term, midterm, and then more long-term solutions that our community should really look at as far as a long-term approach to reducing jail population.
So it started out with the issue of the jail expansion, but then the legislature very thoughtfully said, you know, let's look at what we can do to reduce it. And when they asked CJATI to create the task force, and initially they said 2 community representatives, and we actually had 4. And we had, I think, an incredible team that brought various aspects of the whole community, from people, you know, who had spent time in the system, people who were housing, you know, just every piece of the puzzle. It was a very good team who spent a lot of their summer doing this. And looking at the system, as Deb said, from start to finish, gave us some ideas of where entry into the system came and where we might make a difference and have some intervention. One of the nights was a public input night. That was about halfway through.
Yeah, that was about May 19th, I think, about halfway through. We had an evening session over at the library.
Well, it was good.
It was well attended.
Got some good ideas, and I would like to actually say Eric Lerner, who was one of our public members, and Davi Mosey, one of our public members, who's also with Tompkins Community Action doing the housing piece. The members were dedicated throughout the whole months, and the public night, which I thought brought some really good ideas. One of the things that we actually did find was, as we were looking at the ideas, most of that was reentry. But as we were looking at the system from start to finish. There's the members that were there. It was quite a contingent of expertise all around. And working through that process, and we had quite a few of the meetings during the evening so that the public could attend. The system mapping from start to finish, from the arrest to sentencing, and when we looked at, what we found was actually the best way, what showed the most promise was looking at the ATIs that we had, and we have quite a few, and seeing how we could make them better, seeing if we could tweak them. And we found that as we went through the process, as we were chewing on ideas, a lot of the members of the committee, who are also some CJATI members, said, you know what, let's see if we can start that, and let's see if we can look at that right away. And one of that was looking at who we needed to target for the population. We had some incredible help looking at the jail data, and that was actually one of Eric's fortes, too, and looking at the inmates who were sentenced, inmates who were not sentenced, and seeing who was in for various periods of time so that we could better dovetail where we could make interventions. Some of the things that started already during the course of our work was having counsel at first arraignment, which is after hours, and the defender-based advocacy. Those were by assigned counsel kind of jumping in and working on some of this stuff. The counsel at first appearance is really going very well, and we're seeing differences already, you know, in the population. The defender-based advocacy was a grant funded through the assigned counsel.
I think if I could just add, both of those are grant funded from the state through the Office of the Indigent Legal Services. So it's allowed our assigned counsel office, the county's office, to move forward with some of these initiatives. Many of you may not know what counsel at first appearance really means, and it was something that Judge Littman ordered, basically asked people to start doing. And it means that when someone's arrested and they're taken to a court, be it a rural court or city court, off hours, that there's a rotating list of attorneys who are on the 18B panel, which is our assigned counsel, who come out and appear at the court with the people as they're being arraigned. What we've seen immediately, this has only been in effect for a few months, but we're already seeing lower bails and people being released without bail due to having counsel present at that first appearance. Judges and magistrates feel more secure in releasing people back to the community with an attorney's assurances and discussion of what's going on and what really is merited in the case. So we're seeing changes already around that. The defender-based advocacy just started, and so it hasn't been evaluated yet. Again, it's grant funded through the state. It will allow for a limited number in-depth reviews. It really helps with sentencing. What it does is these are attorneys who are coming down from the Center for Community Alternatives in Syracuse who do an in-depth kind of evaluation of what would be a logical sentence, what are the particular needs of that person. And so that will be evaluated probably in about a year hence to see what the impact is. But it's an exciting first step.
The other thing was the mental health department already started what's called the open access, where if there are mental health issues or someone is having a behavioral incident, you know, on the commons, for example, they will have immediate access over to mental health for triage, basically, and to see what the needs might be, have an immediate session. So I thought that was good because that's starting right away.
This is new. It's 9:30 to 3:30 Monday through Fridays. And what has been an impediment in the past is the need to establish an appointment And then get someone to a mental health appointment after you've gotten an appointment. So this is a new initiative, and again, it'll have to be evaluated 6 months and a year hence to see how it's working, but it's really promising that people can get in when they're in crisis.
So far they haven't been, you know, overloaded all at once. The participation by our sheriff's department, Black Creek is the company that holds the basically the software data package for the jail. And what Black Creek is looking at throughout the state and Tompkins County, the sheriff's office was one of the first to say, you know, put us in there for looking at this, is software that looks at the inmates and then it kind of crafts interventions based on risk levels and needs, and it actually dovetails really well with what we are looking at doing. So we came up with things that we can do fairly quickly, things that we need to explore and look at for the long term. And there was a pretty unanimous feeling, both from the public and the members of the task force. One of the things that has always worked so well with us is the OAR staff, and restoring that back to three, where it was some years ago, was a pretty consistent number one on the to-do list.
Yeah, staff has been handling, two client service workers have been handling what three did for years, for the last 3 years now, and everyone's getting a little bit burned out. It's not just bail. It really is case management. Executing bails is a part of what we do, and it does take some time. But it's not the most time-intensive activity we undertake. We coordinate a group of volunteers who drive families to the jail for visiting days. We meet with inmates in the jail for DSS applications, assigned counsel applications, Social Security applications. I won't go on and on about all we do. I'll have a chance probably during budget to talk to you more about that. But the fact is that it's a big caseload that two client service workers are covering now. So it was a recommendation of the task force and the public to restore OAR to the three client service workers. We also, many of you may recall that OAR's bail fund has been operating for nearly 40 years. January 1st of this year, new state legislation took effect allowing for charitable bail organizations. We never knew we weren't allowed for 40 years, but this new legislation now permits it. It also imposes a number of other restrictions and barriers that we've not operated under before. And so we're going to be seeking through you all and through Barbara Lifton's office state legislation to tweak this charitable bail law, which was clearly drafted by people who've never even had the vaguest idea of what a charitable bail organization was. They're used to dealing with private bail bondsmen. And so when Val and I went down to take our license, you know, it was like everyone else who was in the class was, you know, packing a weapon and driving huge pickup trucks. You know, we show up in, you know, our very small cars and packing no weapons and everything, and they kind of didn't know what to do with us. You know, who are you folks, you know? So the whole process has been a learning experience, but the law needs to be changed. It currently limits charitable bail organizations to a $2,000 maximum bail. We'd like to see that raised to $3,500. Bail levels differ substantially between New York City and upstate. And so this was reflective more of New York City bail levels, I think, and didn't really address the fact that there's a differential here in upstate. The other thing is the legislation is silent about the ability to bail for violations or felonies. And it just talks about misdemeanors. And many of the bails that OAR has done historically have been violations, which are very petty crimes often, and nonviolent felonies. So at any rate, we'll probably be crafting a resolution for your consideration, asking you all to request these changes from the state legislature in the next session.
And the other thing we found, and I know probation works hard on this, but it's communicating with the magistrates in the towns and villages, making sure that they are, you know, very comfortable and educated about the ATIs that we do have. as alternatives to, you know, rather than sentencing people into jail or detaining them in the jails. And there are some trainings that are going to be set up very soon, and I know there's going to be some face-to-face reaching out to the magistrates, so that's already in progress. As we were looking at the system, one of the balloons in the jail ended up being weekenders, people who are sentenced to weekends in the jail, but they have a job, so they're released Monday through Friday so they can retain their job. And it ended up having some pretty lively discussion about, okay, then why are they in there? Is there an alternative that we can put in place for that? And our probation director immediately spoke up and said, you know, we have a weekend work project. And we worked with the jail on finding out how many people generally are in the jail on the weekends, and it ended up being an average of 4. And she said, you know, let's look at absorbing that into our weekend. So she's working with the DA's office and the judges and going to work on that. So that will help. Some things that we need to explore for the midterm to reduce the jail population. Probation used to have what's called the RICS program, and it was a supervised work program where people were allowed to come out of the jail and do their work and then go back into the jail. We need to look at the numbers and explore the feasibility for that. The other thing we noticed as we were working through the system of arrest through sentencing was that some of the police agencies are allowed to take desk bail, but generally sheriffs and state police did not. So we're looking into, if that's authorized, and if it is, how to implement it. And I think that that will help tremendously. And alcohol and drug assessments in the jail, that's already being done, though sometimes there are more than we can accommodate. So we're looking at possible means of increasing the number that's done to get people into treatment faster.
Then we looked at other issues that really need more attention and more in-depth work that have been talked about, some of these issues in numerous other committees in the county, the continuum of care and other groups. They include additional substance abuse services in the jail. This actually came the second point, additional life skills, vocational and educational programs Peter Stein brought to the task force. And it's something that we're going to be exploring further with the sheriff about how some of that time when people are in jail could be used more productively. And how much that would cost, and look at some of those issues, because there's a lot of wasted time when people are in jail. We're also looking for expanding the assertive community treatment program that does exist in part of this county, but because of the state districts, it doesn't exist in the northern townships. It doesn't exist in Lansing or Dryden or Groton. And it really is kind of an intensive case management in the community of people who suffer from chronic and persistent mental illnesses. And it's been very helpful in a number of communities, and I think part of our community that is covered, in reducing incarcerated population amongst those with mental illness. The other thing we thought might be important is the city's talking about initiatives similar, Martha, to what you spoke about in San Antonio, kind of based on some of the work that's being done in Burlington, Vermont as well, which is to have mental health workers, community members really, they don't have to be certified mental health workers, they're really community outreach workers, downtown Ithaca to help do some early interventions on off hours with people who are suffering from mental health and substance abuse issues in an attempt to address what's really the problem that they may be facing at that moment, which may be no place to sleep, it may be no food, it may be something immediate that doesn't really require incarceration. So the city is looking at that, and we're going to be looking at that as it goes through the CJATI. And then we also what are we looking at? Okay, then these are future issues, and they're talked about at a lot of boring length in an appendix to this report. And it's really a white paper on what are some of the really meaningful interventions that are systems changes that may need to take place to really long-term reduce our approach to crime. Obviously, what we've been doing doesn't work. We haven't seen a reduction of crime in my lifetime, even though we've certainly built thousands more jails and cells. And some of these things are expensive, and some of them maybe have money from federal, state, and other levels of government that might help. And it includes transitional housing. We've made improvement in this community. There's a Chartwell House and Magnolia House, and those are housing for people who are in recovery from drug and alcohol abuse. There's been improvement, but it doesn't begin to meet the need. We're still housing a lot of people who come out of our jail in substandard slums in rural areas that are not accessible to transportation. We also need to figure out ways of integrating our access to mental health and substance abuse programs. We put a lot of money in societies, looked at those issues a lot in the last three decades, but we still are very siloed in those approaches. We talk about co-occurring disorders, but we don't really know how to coordinate services between mental health and substance abuse. There's still a lot of work to be done there. The public talked about, and we've seen research that shows that mentoring programs do work in a number of areas. We need to look at that more closely, too. How are they working? Let's get some data on it. We hear qualitative stories, but we don't have much data on the efficacy of mentoring programs locally. There is more data on those that exist in other communities that have received federal funding. And then employment programs to train and facilitate employment of those who have been released from jail. Again, there's some exciting stuff happening locally. Ithaca Reuse is doing some work in this area and has reached out to our clientele. Challenge Industries has done some. But as the economy has slowly improved, there's a whole group of people are being left further and further behind. And so I think these are things that are part of a public policy dialogue that we need to look at moving into the future. It's not going to solve Tompkins County jail population overnight, but these are really some of the underlying issues that are driving our jail population.
So we are ready. The CJATI is actually kind of chomping at the bit to dig in and start working on implementation of the immediate ones and setting up steps for the midterm. One of the things that we will be looking at is effective reentry services, both as people are coming out of the jail, and also we're looking at services in the jail. And, of course, the one thing that limits us at that point is the space in the jail. So that is an issue that we're going to be, looking at over the coming years. The committee has its work cut out for it, the CJATI, and they're anxious to work on it, and we will be reporting back and ready for questions.
That sounds like a cue. Martha Robertson.
Thanks to both, and thanks to the members of the task force who are here, and maybe the ones, I know Susan came in,
yep.
Anybody who's a member from the task force,
yeah, could you
raise
introduce
their hand?
Them to us, please?
Yeah. We've got Eric Lerner here, who you heard from earlier. Next to him is Susan Begg, who is a community member on the task force, and Davi Mosey. I always do that wrong. Davi, who served on the task force as well.
Thank you very much. Really very appreciative of your service. A couple of things. You said on the expanding the weekend service, so the SWAP program on the weekend. So help me, when you reported all this to the Public Safety Committee, I meant to ask this but didn't. So we already do supervised weekend service through the probation department?
Correct.
Okay. So we're not adding staff that aren't doing something else, no extra overtime or something like right. that?
At this point, Pat was pretty sure that the fairly low numbers of weekenders could be absorbed. If that grows, you know, we'll have to look at it.
Okay.
But I thought the neat part of that was more of the we can do attitude, and let's look at it right now.
Okay, that sounds great. And that makes a lot of sense. Are we seeing this issue of drugs and alcohol? Are we seeing, maybe this is outside your area, but is there any reduction in the local high schools in guidance counselors or any other kind of counselors who might in the past have helped kids to deal with problems like this, so they don't leave high school and they're already addicted or you know, they have.
I can't quantify that. You can.
I'm in pretty much every school in the county at some point or another with the juvenile population and the staff there. I haven't seen decreases like that. What we are, you know, in the staffing, you know, the smaller school, it just depends on how intensely they work, you know, with the kids for whatever they're doing. The school psychologists are well aware, you know, of the influx of drugs in the last, well, Judge Raleigh has, you know, said he's seen it. He was on our task force for 10 years, and the heroin that's coming in and things like that. We've gone cyclical with the juveniles over periods of time with oxycodone and prescription drugs and things like that.
What we are seeing at OAR is third generational addiction issues. So that what it is you know, it's continuing through families. And so, again, something needs to happen earlier, and it's probably way before high school because kids in the middle school, I know the health department and the youth services department of the county have really worked hard on some of the addiction issues.
It is earlier rather than later.
Right. And then, Deb, I think it was your question about have we decreased, that we haven't really seen a decrease in crime over the years. We have seen an increase in our county, we've seen an increase in our population, and the fact that our really crude measure, but our jail population has been pretty stable for a long time, even though the population's growing, that kind of does say that we've actually, you know, somehow managed and maybe kept the rates down.
I think we've done exceptionally well in Tompkins County because of the ATIs that are in place. I just think I was talking more globally as a culture. We're not seeing serious reductions in crime rates based on our model of treatment. But locally, we've done very well, I think, in keeping incarceration rates down.
Jim Dennis.
One question. The open access system at mental health, appointments no longer required. What does that mean? I mean, I know what it means, but someone can now walk into mental health?
Yeah. What it means is that we, in the past, for instance, would have a client who would show up at OAR in crisis, having hallucinations.
Okay,
let's just make up a story, though it does happen. And we would call mental health, and they'd say, well, next Wednesday at 2 o'clock, we can see them. Now what we can do is we can say, you know what, Joe, we're going to walk over right now to mental health, you know, or fly on the magic balloon or however we're going to do it. We're going to get over to mental health right now, and one of us will walk them over and sit there until someone sees them, so that it's immediate.
All right, so there is generally someone from an agency along with a potential client.
It could be an officer as well, I think. It could be, or...
they qualify from an agency.
Usually people need encouragement to get there.
All right. Thank you.
Peter Stein.
The whole business of the jail is a very complicated thing, and there's no right answer. We all know that, and I won't argue with anybody when they say it's barbarous to put human beings in cages. and I agree with it. But on the other hand, I'm damned if I know what to do without it. You can't find any society in the world today that does not have some aspect of incarceration in it. And I wonder, I think with any new program like this, one should think in advance of some way of trying to evaluate whether it had any utility or not. And then the question becomes, what is the utility? What is it you're trying to do? And it seems to me there are two different answers. One is to keep people out of jail. That's pretty easy to measure, although it's not so hard to interpret why exactly it happened. But I think that's not the right measure. The right measure is to decrease crime. Again, I don't have any suggestions to make, but I think that's something that should be thought about, is to try to establish what is the goal of this. And I honestly don't think it should simply be to keep people out of jail. And the place where this, you know, I'm telling you what I really think. I have very little, until I joined the program of driving people to jail, I had very, very little contact. I think no contact whatsoever to anybody who'd been in jail. So it's a new experience for me, and I've learned an enormous amount from doing that jail driving. I haven't talked to any convicts, but I've talked to the families of the convicts at great length. One thing, I mean, there is some aspect of jail which is punishment, and you can't entirely forget that. Now, the crime that the people I know and I'm close to mostly commit is DWI. And I know to those people the idea of having to spend weekends in jail is a real punishment. It's something that they might think about in advance. And those same people, I think, would not particularly maybe like to work in work projects, but I think they'd like to be in jail a whole lot less. So it's not even clear to me that is an advance. Just a comment. But I think the whole thing ought to be thought through about how we evaluate the success of whatever programs we put into action.
Carol Chalk.
I want to ask some more specific details. You mentioned the program that there are attorneys coming down from Syracuse.
Yes, the defender-based advocacy program that's housed in the assigned counsel office of the county, but they're contracting with the Center for Community Alternatives in Syracuse, who have defender-based advocacy expertise.
Okay, and there's nobody closer. I mean, as I recall, you know,
some of the work that OAR does is defender-based advocacy, but we're not attorneys, and so we're still doing what we do that is defender-based advocacy. But these are attorneys who are licensed and practice, and I think that they're basically the closest.
And part of the grant is also for them to train our local attorneys. One of the things they do differently than assigned counsel, they have the time to get more intensely into the strengths of a defendant, the other possible resources that a defendant may have to implement to offer alternatives rather than the jail. They delve into it more deeply and more intensely, but part of that is training our assigned counsel, so hopefully will be local.
So I'm just recalling that in some prior years, going back a few decades, Cornell University had a program that was overseen by staff attorneys, law school attorneys, who oversaw law students who performed some of this same kind of work. Is that no longer?
I think that went the way of the dodo as Cornell Law School turned to more corporate law and less criminal law, quite honestly. There is still some criminal and family law happening at Cornell, but it's not a big player.
Okay. And then on the program that you mentioned to have people doing more productive programs to while they're in jail, to Eric Lerner's list that he gave at the beginning, I would add to it, you know, and have them sit with nothing to do and not much programming that talks about how to live life differently. And I'm just wondering if you looked at it in the kind of depth. I know you didn't have time to go into a lot of depth on any of these, but the kind of depth that would tell us something more about whether existing staff from either agencies or the Department of Corrections would be able to start some of this more immediately without having to come up with a lot of money.
There has been, we have, Tompkins is pretty service rich in services and volunteers and trained people, you know, willing to do that. I think the thing that is most detrimental to the programming in the jail right now is the lack of space.
OAR did run a choices program for 18 months, or actually 18 months, but only 6 months of it was in the jail, which was a program for female inmates that talked about some of those thought processes and how to make different decisions. And we were grant-funded through United Way for that helped us manage to do that. And we just don't have the capacity to do it with two people. But it shows some promise, I think. And plus, we still hear from the inmates who participated how really meaningful it was, and they pop in pretty regularly into the office.
And I don't mean we don't do any programming up there. Probation's doing Thinking for a Change, which is trying to stop the impulsiveness, which sometimes leads to crime. You know, GED, you know, the employment piece from probation. They're doing some things, but certainly we would like to do more.
No, I'm just wondering if the sheriff's department, the people who are in the jail every day watching people, couldn't be doing more to spend some of that time with groups of inmates.
I just like to say I think that they have a pretty high caseload with what they're doing right now, and we are seeing increased numbers of people in the jail with mental health issues. And there's a lot of monitoring and observation that goes in when you have that number. I think it's worth looking at in the future. I think it require more training and, you know, of the current correction officers.
I have Will, then Martha would like another opportunity, and I'd kind of like to conclude.
Thank you, Michael. And thanks to the whole task force and the folks that came tonight. I did attend several meetings, and I was totally impressed by the diversity and then just the intelligence of the discussions that were happening and the complexity that you all are facing. Absent from your recommendations are any estimates of cost. I assume those will be forthcoming in terms of within the budget time period. So I will be very interested. And I understand Peter's desire to have some way of measuring the effectiveness. Unfortunately, there are so many variables here. I mean, we don't know. I would imagine it's impossible to know the impact of any one particular program. But if we can, you know, to whatever extent we can figure out, okay, this will in fact give some evidence that this has been working, it would be helpful. But once again, thank you very much, and I hope that we all will be take these to heart and be able to find ways to fund many of them.
Thank you.
Yeah, just it was a training piece on our local attorneys, because they do have those CLEs where they need to do training every year anyway, and that would be a terrific resource to be able to build that capacity here. Thanks.
Thank you both. Thank you for the whole group. Brian, can we expect a resolution accepting this report in the near future?
Yes. I was hoping that would be today, but certainly, yes. Yep.
Through the Public Safety Committee?
Yes.
Thank you. We'll suspend for just briefly while we put the screens back up.
PowerPoint. It's all PowerPoint.
Thank you. For my report, I would just like to mention that quarterly we have a group from the county that meets with a group from Cornell and talks about county and Cornell issues. And we had that meeting last week up at the Cornell Heat Plant, of all places. And after the meeting was over, we were pleased to have a tour of that facility, particularly the new turbines that they have, gas-powered turbines that create so much electricity, coupled with the turbine at BB Lake, that they're able to provide all the electric power that that campus needs. Seems amazing. We talked about a number of different issues. Particularly, we spent a lot of time talking about TCAT, and we all heard the TCAT budget presentation, and Cornell is an equal partner with us and with the city of Ithaca, so that's pretty important. We talked about Cornell's plans to look at the East Hill Plaza area. We talked about the new incubator downtown, which is nearly complete, and they do have some interest in different clients that may want to locate there. We heard about their hope to expand the veterinary school up at Cornell and increase the class size from 90 to 120, and that would include a larger building and hopefully some new staff and faculty there. We talked about the Ithaca City's stormwater utility credits issue. We talked about gas drilling on Cornell property, whether that ban would continue. Overall, it was a good meeting and a lot of issues. I can't say we had a lot of promises from Cornell, not that we expected them, but it aired a number of issues. Sure, if you have any questions, I'm glad to answer them.
Yeah, just quick, what was the answer on the whether the gas ban on drilling on campus would continue?
Apparently that is a policy not of the Board of Trustees, we were told, but of President Skorton. Mm-hmm. And so it is a policy that could change with a new president. It didn't say it would change, but it is at the administrative level and not at the board level. So they weren't able to say what will happen next year when President Skorton leaves.
So in the follow-up, in light of that, what was the upshot of the conversation that happened months earlier about some participation in the interviewing or the search process for a new president for Cornell? Some of the issues that are important to the community.
Yeah, we actually did have that meeting that we were some of us were invited to, and that took place right before graduation. And so that was the only opportunity that we had. And we talked. There were people from the Chamber of Commerce and from the business community and from the city, and we talked about a lot of community issues like that.
Who heard the?
There were trustees at that time from the chair of the committee, the search committee, and trustees that were serving on that search committee that were in Ithaca at the time. And that we were told from that point forward, from commencement forward, after they had talked with a number of different groups and received input, it would be a closed search at that point.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a couple of chair's appointments to the Workforce Investment Board. I have Jennifer Tavares from an economic development organization, obviously Chamber of Commerce, and Diane Braddock, WIA Title I program representative. We'll go next to reports from staff. Our county administrator is Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Michael. I have the pleasure of making a couple of introductions tonight. The second of the two, I'll wait until the end of my reports as a part of a confirmation request to the legislature. The first, though, is a new intern in my office. Heijin Huang is here with us tonight, and I always forget to ask the person to stand up and wave so you know who they are.
Please stand up and wait.
Cajun is here tonight with us. She's an intern in our office. She's going to be with our office for the complete academic year as a part of the program that she's in at Cornell, which is a public service scholar program. And I've said this in other meetings, so she's probably embarrassed by it still, but it means she is really smart to be in a program like this. She is an incoming senior at Cornell. She spent the last year studying at Oxford. So it's an easy transition from Oxford to county administration. So I think that's why she chose us. Again, she'll be with us 8 to 10 hours a week. She's going to be involved in some of the shared service things that we do. She has a particular interest in the court study that may or may not happen. We've talked about the municipal court system. So if that does happen, we will want to involve Hagen in that. So we're very happy that she's with us and glad to introduce her tonight. On the budget, we're a couple of weeks away now from delivering you the budget. I'll bring you the tentative budget the night after Labor Day. It's nearing completion right now. We're putting the finishing touches on our recommendations. Without getting into the specifics of it, I'll tell you that the tentative budget will be within the parameters that you established way back in the early summer, which holds us to a 2.3% increase in 2.36% increase in levy. I said last time in your last meeting that our projections in the springtime were pretty close to the mark, which means that there's not a heck of a lot of additional money available to us to be able to fund some of the OTRs that have come in. OTRs totaled about $1 million, a little over $1 million, with a little more than half of that in local dollars. So we're not going to be able to provide full funding for all of those OTRs. So as the budget comes to you, there will be some OTRs, over-target requests, that are either unfunded or partially funded for you to consider when it comes to you. So, again, that's on September 2nd for your meeting then. So I'll have the PowerPoint screens down for that event. Last thing in my report is another introduction, and it's really a request for you to confirm an appointment of a department head. And as we always do when we come to a point of confirmation, I ask that the legislature, because this is a personnel issue, if you wish to adjourn to executive session, I would ask the chair to do that. So if there is a desire to do that, we can do that now. Otherwise, I can proceed and provide some backgrounds and proceed to the request for confirmation.
Does anyone wish to have an executive session? Don't see any requests. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay. So before I talk about the appointee who is here with us tonight, Deborah Griffith Palermo, I just want to remind you of the process that has brought us to this point. Anita Fitzpatrick, who all of you know has served as our personnel commissioner for 25 years, advised us of her plan to retire many months ago. I think it was in the early spring when she let us know that she had hoped to retire this year. We took time to gear up for this search. We put together a recruitment plan to make sure that we advertised this position as widely and broadly as we possibly could. We wanted to make sure that the job description was still on the mark and that our recruitment materials, and I hope you've taken a look at those materials, not only describe the job, but also the county and the community. Our goal was to really entice people to take a hard look at this position, both for the position and for basically the quality of life that we offer in Tompkins County. In June of this year, I convened a search committee that included me, two legislators, Jim Dennis and Kathy Luz Herrera, were on that committee. Each of our cabinets had a department head representative, so Jeff Smith represented the infrastructure cabinet, Jay Franklin from the administrative cabinet, Patricia Carey from the human services cabinet were all on the search committee, as was County Attorney Jonathan Wood. We also invited, and he participated, the president of our largest employees union, Doug Perrine, who heads up the CSEA white-collar unit. And we had two outside HR professionals who joined us as well. Sharon Dovey from TC3, their HR director at TC3, and Shelley Michelle Nunn, who all of you know is the city's human resources commissioner. Beyond that, we had Paula Younger and Anita herself, who served kind of as consultants to the search committee. So obviously we took this process very seriously, as we should, because this is a key position with the county. The group had the advantage of a very large and very talented pool of candidates. Over the course of 3 months, they reviewed 25 resumes, conducted two rounds of interviews to end at this point. In the end, the search committee recommended the appointment of Deborah Griffith Palermo, and I've accepted the search committee's recommendations. I've shared Deb's resume with you, so you've had a chance, I think, to look at what you would all agree is an extensive resume and background in HR. I'll hit just a couple of the high points of what's in that resume and what the search committee saw. She spent 28 years in human resources, most of it in the public sector in Monroe County. Her most recent position was VP of Human Resources for the Monroe Muffler Brake Corporation. That's not the corner brake store. That's the 5,800-person corporation that runs those operations. Before that, really began her or concluded her public sector experience. She was with the Rochester Genesee Transit Authority for 7 years, mostly as chief administrative officer. That's an 800-person transit system. That job included management of virtually all aspects of human resources. For 19 years prior to that, she served in the Monroe County Personnel Department, and she started at the bottom and worked her way up. She started as an employee safety technician, and she rose steadily and ultimately became the county's director of labor relations. That position had broad responsibilities, including serving as that 4,000-person county's chief labor negotiator. The search committee, in looking at the resume and Ms. Palermo, found her to be a highly knowledgeable and goal-directed manager who also possesses very strong leadership skills. So based on that, I'm requesting your confirmation of my appointment. I believe that we have found in Deb Griffith Palermo an individual who is uniquely qualified to succeed Anita Fitzpatrick, who's done a remarkable job over her 25 years, and someone who will build on the successes that Anita and her staff have achieved. In asking for your confirmation, I also advise you this is a term appointment. So this has a term that most of our department heads don't have. It's a 6-year term by statute. It relates to the fact that this job has responsibilities really to the state. It's the state civil service officer. And much like DSS and health, that linkage to the state carries with it a statutory term. This is a 6-year term. So in making this appointment, we are making an appointment to that 6-year term. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would ask for a motion to confirm my appointment of Deborah Griffith Palermo to the position of Personnel Commissioner and for a confirmation vote by the full legislature.
Before I call for that, could we ask Deborah to stand up?
Absolutely.
And maybe we can get a camera on her so folks at home can see who she is as well.
Can she say something?
Would you like to say something to us? Come right up to the podium here.
Well, I just want to thank you all for a very warm welcome. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joining such a great team, and I look forward to this next chapter in my career. Very much appreciate the confidence Jill and the search committee has in my skills and abilities, and I will make sure I don't let you down. Thank you.
Now, Jim Dennis, would you like to make a motion?
Yes. Michael, I would move that approval for Deborah Griffith Palermo to be the new commissioner of personnel.
I have a second from Dave McKenna. Discussion about the appointment. Ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand.
Aye.
All those opposed? That's unanimous. Congratulations. Martha?
Joe, can you talk about a transition and how long Anita will be here and all that?
Deb will start the day that I present the budget, so she'll be beginning the day after Labor Day. Anita has agreed to stay on as long as we would like her to. I think the transition is probably a week or two, but also she's agreed to be on call, so if situations arise, she has agreed to make herself available.
We're going to miss her. She's been very good. Dooley.
I hope that you will ask Anita if she will remain available to help us review that section of the charter when we get to it.
I did that today.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact.
Anything else, Joe?
That's my report. Thank you.
Any questions for Joe? Let's go to Jonathan Wood, the county attorney.
I do not have a report.
That was short. Finance Director Rick Snyder.
I have the sales tax report for you tonight. This is for the month of July. Just 2 weeks ago, we reviewed June's activity, which told us we were right around 50% in collections for 50% through the year. Now with one more month under our belt, I thought I'd share with you July's sales tax distribution. The county was up, comparing this July to last July, the county was up 2.28%. Year-to-date distributions for the county's portion total $18,847,073, and that compares to $18,211,551 in 2013. This represents an increase of 3.49% year over year. We should be at 58.3% of our budget right now, and we are currently at collections of 57.4% of budget. So we are off by just roughly about 1%. And that's all I have for this evening.
Questions for Rick?
I'm sorry, those last two numbers, we should be at where?
We should be at around 58%, and we're at 57%.
Okay, thanks.
Mike?
Go ahead, Will.
So the fact that we're still off, are we still doing playing catch-up from last winter, or is that?
We're within 1% of budget, so we're very close to where we should be at.
Okay.
Resolutions to be added or withdrawn to the agenda. Jim Dennis.
Thank you, Michael. Yes, I am adding authorizing an intermunicipal agreement between Tompkins County and Cortland and County Tompkins and Cortland County regarding the payment of debt issued to support the TC3 campus master plan project.
Okay, that's resolution what? I?
J.
That's resolution J. I believe there's a resolution I. Dave McKenna.
Yes, I'd like to add authorizing the county administrator to grant access easement to build and service a solar energy facility at Tompkins-Cortland Community College, TC3, and that's resolution 5035.
Can any others to be added or withdrawn? Can we vote on adding those? All those in favor? All those opposed? Those are added. Carol, was there something else you wanted to ask about?
No, I was seconding the adding of the solar array.
Not sure we need a second for them, but it's fine. All right, let's go into the consent agenda then, please. If anyone wants a resolution taken off the consent agenda, please just say so. We'll come back to it later. Out of the Health and Human Services Committee, we have Resolution A, 4985, Grant Acceptance and Budget Adjustment for the Tompkins County Transition Support Program Office for the Aging. Resolution B, ID 5006, Budget Adjustment, 2014 State Allocations, Youth Services Department. From the Public Safety Committee, Resolution C, ID 5014, Authorizing Acceptance of New York State Public Safety Answering Point Consolidation Improvements and Enhancements Grant, Agents or Department of Emergency Response. Resolution D, from Facilities and Infrastructure, that's 5013, Budget Adjustment to Transfer Funds from the Highway Materials to the Electric Account, Highway Division, pending, has been passed out of the committee.
Mike?
Yes?
Is Lee only here for that one? Is there any way for me to ask a question so that Lee doesn't, before Lee leaves, without pulling this off the consent agenda?
Well, that's not the procedure.
So then I'll take it off.
All right. We'll pull D off. I'm sorry. Is it D you want off or you want C off?
C.
C off. C is off. Other than C, all those in favor of the consent agenda, please. I need a second. A motion and a second. I'm sorry. Martha Robertson moving, Leslie McBean, Claire Bourne seconding. All those in favor of the consent agenda, please raise your hand. Those opposed, that's unanimous. Carol, as an accommodation, we'll take that resolution. Would you please move that, Brian?
Sure. I will move Resolution C, ID 5014, authorizing acceptance of New York State Public Safety Answering Point Consolidation Improvements and Enhancement Grants, Department of Emergency Response.
Is there a second? Seconded by Leslin. Carol, your question?
Yeah, so I just wanted to know some more information about the enhanced capabilities, what the next generation means, and in particular something about the amount of information that it enables to be collected about anybody it encounters or not.
Hey, it's almost like talking about the radio system. I could go on all night, but I'll make it as brief as I can, Carol. This will allow us to replace the telephone systems that were installed just 10 years ago when we built the 911 center on Brown Road. And at the time, it was on traditional switching-style telephone equipment. And since that time, developed has been IP technology, Internet protocol, and this will allow us to move from the traditional switch-based, copper-based systems into enhanced 911 information. And when we talk about next-generation 911, that allows us to add the capabilities to locate phone calls that come through text messaging, and also be able to receive photographs, streaming video, all the types of things you can't do through the copper wire today. And those are under development, so it's IP, next generation technology capable. And then the system that, as I mentioned, that we have today is 10 years old and just about beyond its useful life. And we're fortunate that this grant came available and that we were able to apply. It also allows us to interconnect with other IP-based phone systems.
So does it allow us to record and keep, say, all the calls that come in by any of these methods? And if so, for how long?
We do record and have always recorded the telephone systems. At this point, it's just the voice communications. The new system will allow us to record that and put it in a database. And with the technology that's capable today, it's indefinite the amount of time you can keep that on servers. We've had the new the current system for 10 years, and we're still recording equipment. I think state law requires us to keep it 90 days, but we've never disposed of it. And, in fact, we back up all that information and it's provided to the district attorney's office for keeping for evidentiary purposes.
Great. And does it allow us, one more, so I'm sorry if you don't mind. Does it allow us to record and keep calls that aren't made directly to our system? Or between the various
anything that comes into the 911 center will be recorded through that. As far as radio system, that's a separate recording, and we do maintain radio communications for selected channels in perpetuity.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your answers.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Any other questions on this? Ready to vote? All those in favor of approving this, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That's carried. Unanimous. We'll go right down the rest of it. We'll come back, Brian, for the rest of your report.
Yep.
But we have some staff here for Health and Human Services, too. So, Peter? Peter Stein, Chair of Health and Human Services Committee.
At our last meeting, we had a number of small issues, and a fair amount of the time was discussed talking about the OTRs of the youth services. And I don't want to talk about that. I thought I would just let Amy present that in her own fashion at the appropriate time. But I wanted to take just a few minutes describing exactly what youth services are in this county. I know I myself have been quite confused by these apparently overlapping programs. It's not simple. There are interlocking programs. So I'll just take a few minutes, if that's okay, to describe what it is that the youth services are. The county has got three independent youth services programs. The first is the Recreation Partnership, which is a partnership, mostly sports activities that are organized around the school districts and the Ithaca Youth Bureau. The county, the city of Ithaca, and the town of Ithaca each provide a quarter of the funding, and the other partners together, the other partners, which are the other municipalities, provide another quarter. The county also supplies staff support for that. And that is considered to be a successful and ongoing program. I represent the county on its board, and they seem to be healthy and having and their financial situation seems in order. The second thing is the Municipal Youth Services System, and that's a county program. What we do there is municipalities match county funding to operate youth development programs for not the large number of youth, but for underserved and challenged youth. In 2010, the county funding of $45,000 was cut substantially. In 2011, $120,000 of county funding was cut. That system is not in good shape. It's not clear how long that is able to go on at the level of funding that there is. The fourth program is Tompkins County Youth Services also funds a set of agencies that provide not recreation, but provide for those youths anywhere in the county who are most at risk. And in particular, that means pregnant and parenting teens, runaway homeless youth, and sexually abused children. And those are the three programs that the County Youth Bureau operates. There's a fourth program, which is operated outside of the county. The county has nothing to do with it. And these are the local recreation programs, and they're operated by municipalities that use local schools for space and fields provided by towns and villages. They receive no county funding. So that is, in a nutshell, what the youth programs are in Tompkins County. Now, to go through the other things that we learned at our meeting, the first is that mental health reported on what is known as the breach incident policy, something that's required by the federal government. It means breach of privacy. Anytime there is some event whereby some medical information, which is private, somehow gets out of the office, there are a series of things that have to be done, and that policy has been done, and it's in operation. We heard from the Human Services Coalition, a funding review. Just some numbers to tell you what they do. The Human Services Coalition disperses about $820,000 in a year to a large bunch of small not-for-profit organizations. The Human Services Coalition will request $5,000 from the city and the county for a homeless services coordination position. The funding for the Human Services Coalition comes mostly from New York State, and the county contribution to that operation is 12.5%. The Health Department. The Health Department, there's a... We will recommend, and I will move this at the end of this list. We will recommend a public hearing to hear local laws, which will extend the electronic, called ENDS, E-N-D-S, and it extends electronic nicotine delivery systems to the local law that regulates smoking in places of employment and restaurants and taverns. At the moment, those are the e-cigarettes what we're talking about, but there are other systems that also do the same thing. There was some dispute about this in the committee. The question is raised is how dangerous is this? Aren't the risks of these new systems less than the risk of cigarettes? And it is really a little bit up in the air now as to exactly what the risks are in these new delivery systems of nicotine. But we believe in the Health Department of the United States suggests that those be regulated in some way and not simply be allowed to be sold and delivered without any controls on them. COFA. There's a new COFA program. The goal is to reduce the, it sounds a little bit like the Medicaid redesign team. The idea is an attempt to save money for elderly people. It's called the Balanced Incentives Program. And the idea is to try to reduce the number of people that go out of a hospital, go home and come back into the hospital at the same very soon. And this is a program that we will do that provides home visits by visiting nurses to seniors that have been discharged from hospitals. And the idea is that they will provide some information and care which keeps those seniors from coming back into the hospital. Mental health. Cyril Manchek, the director of mental health, pointed out that it's well known that individuals with mental illnesses recover more quickly when they have access to mainstream housing, and she asked us to be aware of this fact when considering the old jail library, the old jail library project. The old library. It's hard to keep them all straight. The old courthouse, the old jail, the old library. I get mixed up. And the last thing that was reported was Patricia Carey from DSS reported that DSS has had open satellite locations in Enfield and Trumansburg and are evaluating how useful they are, how many people come to them, and they're considering an additional location in Groton. And that concludes my report, and I believe I have this resolution.
Let me see if there are any questions for you on your report. Julie Kiefer.
The satellite locations for DSS, how many hours or days are they open?
I'm sorry.
How many days or hours are the satellite locations for DSS open?
I honestly don't remember. It was certainly not 40 hours a week. I don't know if anybody else remembers. I had the feeling it was one day a week or something like that was the frequency of it. But they are going to evaluate that.
Okay, Peter, you want to move your resolution, please?
Yeah, if I can find it.
Resolution E.
It's I'd like to have it in front of me before moving. Okay. Resolution E, which is authorizing a public hearing on the proposed local law, amending the local law number 3 of 2003, which is a local law amending the chapter 72 of the Tompkins County Code to restrict smoking in places of employment, restaurants, and taverns. And the way it's going to be amended is to add the electronic means of delivery of nicotine to what is covered by tobacco.
Is there a second? Seconded by Leslie. Discussion. Julie Kiefer.
I was puzzled when I read this at first, because although we were promised a copy with red and blue track changes, it was just black and white. So I decided I better try to figure out what the changes were a little more precisely. And to that end, I wondered if packet page 14, letter G, should repeat the words that are in the title of this article of the code, that it applies to places of employment, restaurants, and bars. Seems to me that to be consistent, those extra words should be added. I became also confused by the underlined bold-faced language on page 14 at the bottom, where it seems to me there are extra words that you probably didn't mean to include. It says electronic nicotine delivery systems, paren ENDS, and paren means, and electronic nicotine delivery system, paren ENDS, is. And I think that the last handful of words should be struck because they're redundant, so that it would...
I'm sorry, what are the last... What do you want to strike?
In the bottom paragraph that is bold-faced and underlined, in the first line toward the end...
The one that says electronic nicotine delivery system ends and ends in the word by user. Is that right? Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay. And what do you want...
In the first line... Yeah. I would get rid of the last four words, which are redundant, and in the next line I get rid of the first three words, which simply repeat the same language that's just been said. I think it was a typo, but I think if we're going to put a local law out for public hearing, we might as well make that correction too. And throughout there are a few places where whiches should be thats, and those you all don't consider substantive, but I think they're simple corrections.
Can I ask... Who can speak to that, as to whether those words should be removed from the proposal, Jonathan or Frank or Ted?
I mean, I agree. It does appear to be a typo. It repeats the same thing.
Are we okay with that?
All right.
Yes, that's fine.
So
is that friendly then?
Yeah, that'll be friendly.
I also tried to reach Mr. Krupa yesterday. He was not in, and I spoke with Mr. Shealy, who nicely sent me an emailed copy of the information that went to the Board of Health, because apparently neither the HHS committee nor the legislature in its information about this local law had as much information as the Board of Health was given. So I received that this morning, and what was interesting about what went to the Board of Health is that there were a number of internet addresses that one could look up to get current information as one could get. And so I took that occasion to print out the first three pages of one of those references and had that put in your red packets. It's the one that the World Health Organization requested. And I put in three other pages from another document, and there are many, many more. I doubt that many of you had time to look any of these up. But what I came away with was thinking that this is not just, it maybe could potentially have impact. I think there's no question that given that there are fine particulates which get inhaled no matter what, that is a contribution to air pollution that should be avoided. Some of those fine particulates seem like really bad actors, but not all of the electronic delivery systems have been tested. However, there are plenty of them on sale now, which should be avoided, in my opinion, based on what I read this morning in these documents. So I would like to see us not have so many qualifying words potential in here, And I don't know whether that would be friendly or not. So I would like to pose
so
that.
So can you make it a little clearer what you're asking?
Well, I'm asking that everybody read what I sent out, but I don't think that's possible. And I'm looking at, I can't remember where it is. The word potential appears a couple of places. It's also in G.
I do not consider that friendly. There was a lot of discussion at the meeting that we had, the HHS meeting, and some people felt that if you didn't put that word in, you were overstating your case. I'm not sure I agree with them, but and the consensus of the group was that it was better with the word potential in there.
Julie, you want to move that as an amendment?
Yes, I will. And the reason that I sent out a little bit of information is that I thought maybe potential was as strong as we could be, but now that I've read more about it, I think I would move to amend the first use of potential, which says to be changed to likely, and the second use of the word potential I would get rid of completely. That's in the last line of G. So that I would move on the third line to get rid of the word potential, a potential public health risk, and change it to a likely public health risk. And in the last line, these irritants could cause harm. That's already saying it weaker than I think it needs to be.
Is there a second? I'll second. Discussion? Will?
I understand Dooley's concern, and I appreciate those materials that you sent. I will take time to look into them. I think there's a lot of unknowns, and one of the things that became very clear is that one of our problems is there is a lack of standardization, lack of regulation. So there's probably huge variations among these, or it could be variations among these devices and the actual impacts. And I really feel that the language that the committee accepted is truer to what we know at this time. I fully accept there may be problems, there could be problems. I think it's an appropriate thing to do. But I think at this point, saying in a blanket, really firm way that we know that is more than we know. So I hope we stay with the original language.
Anyone else? Dan?
Yeah, I'm just wondering if, so the Board of Health was the ones that put that wording in there who apparently had access to this information before tonight. I'm wondering if anybody can speak to why the Board of Health decided to have that
Frank
wording.
Frank or Ted or both of you? Frank Krupa, our Commissioner of Health.
Good evening, everyone. The Board of Health, the word potential was added at HHS. That was a new word in the third line. In the final line of that, it was there. That came from the Board of Health. So there's a lot of unknown, as Will mentioned, related to these products. As the public health director, I feel strongly that there is risk. And that there, even if you're dealing with, at a minimum, folks that have asthma or respiratory issues, just as if they're exposed to perfume or large amounts of perfume, those kind of things can be affected. So what Dooley is presenting certainly fits with what we as the health department would support. The reality is this is the intent section of the law, and to be quite honest, we were looking at it as that's your, as the legislature's opportunity to explain your feelings about where this stands. So like I said, we would certainly be supportive of Dooley's language, but recognize that you all have to decide for, as the legislature, on how to word your intent related to the law.
Mike Siegler.
I actually had a question for Frank. So is the Board of Health's contention that this is the secondhand part of this? I mean, you don't call it smoke. I guess the secondhand vapor. That is dangerous to people around.
Correct.
Anyone else on the amendment? Carol Chuck.
Well, is this something that we could be changed when it comes back to us? We're setting a public hearing now, so we could hear comments on this. We could have it more. We can pass this tonight, hear comments, have more of a chance to digest what Dooley has sent out, and still come back. Would we be able to change those words after hearing from the public, or is that too substantial a change? Is this probably a question for Jonathan Wood.
Well, as you say, the legal requirement is if it's a substantial change. If it's a substantial change, it would mean that you would have to have another public hearing. In my view, just my gut view, is that it would not be, simply because it doesn't change the law at all. It just basically is your stating the belief, but it doesn't really change any substantive thing about the law. So I would think it's not substantial.
Anyone else? You're ready to vote on the amendment. Can we restate the amendment, Kathy?
Peck at page 14, paragraph G, changing the first word potential to likely and removing it in the last line.
Ready to vote? All those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. That's two. Those opposed? That's everyone else. The amendment fails. Let's proceed to the... are we ready to vote on the main motion, establishing the public hearing? I guess we are. All those in favor of the motion, please, or the resolution, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you.
So I hope that you all will have time to read more about this, and I'm glad that Jonathan would find those changes not substantial so that we could consider them after the public hearing.
I think we'll go to Facilities and Infrastructure Committee next. Kathy Luz Herrera is not here tonight, so we'll go to Dave McKenna as the vice chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We met August 18th. We were addressed by a group from the Pine Tree Neighborhood Association about changes to the residential end of Pine Tree Road. They were upset over the fact that they weren't consulted on a TAP grant that was applied for, and we told them that the grant was a menu of things that could be done and didn't necessarily have to be done, and that Jeff Smith would get with them and we would have a meeting to decide which parts of that TAP grant we wanted to implement and which parts they didn't want any part of, and go on from there. In addition to that, we worked on the resolution for the TC3 and the electric traffic signal power.
I wonder on the Pine Tree Hill or Pine Tree Road discussion, did the committee take any action at that point, or is it?
No, we hadn't taken any action on it yet. We will have a public meeting on this sometime in the near future. But I don't know if Jeff has established exactly when he wants to have that yet.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Let
me just see if there's any other questions for you, Dave.
Oh, sure.
Not seeing any. Please move your resolution, Jay.
Yeah, I'd like to move resolution. I think it's I.
Sorry, it's I.
5035, authorizing county administrator to grant access easement to build and service solar facility at Tompkins Corlin Community College, and I so move.
Is there a second? Seconded by Leslin. Discussion. Martha.
I'm trying to figure out in the first whereas, This is to install a solar array to promote the use of non-renewable energy by TC3.
Is that a typo?
I think that's a typo.
Okay. So it should say promote the use of renewable energy by TC3.
That's friendly.
Very friendly.
Julie?
I don't understand why we're being asked to do this. I didn't think we owned that land. I thought TC3 owned the land.
Jonathan, you want to speak to that, please?
Yeah, I can't explain that. As you know, TC3 has this agreement with this solar company to put a solar array on land owned by TC3, and it's about 10, 11 acres. It's a 2-megawatt solar array. The company is planning to finance it, and in viewing the financing, the title company believed that they needed an access easement over land, which is technically in the name of the two counties and not in the name of TC3. Now, TC3 and the two counties all believe that TC3 has the right to give the solar company access. It does not need any permission from the counties. However, the solar company can't get financing because their title company is being, I'm not sure what to use the word, perhaps unreasonable. But because of that, TC3 has asked us and Cortland County to pass this resolution, although none of us believe it's necessary. If we don't do it, the project won't go forward because the company won't get financing.
Jonathan, is it correct that if the solar panels go away or wear out or whatever, this easement dies?
Right. The easement is just to access, build and access the solar panels. So if they're not there, there's no easement.
Thank you. Any other questions? Are ready to vote on the resolution? All those in favor? Those opposed? That's unanimous. We'll go next to the Economic Development Committee. Will Burbank is chair.
Thank you, Michael. The Economic Development Committee met yesterday, and we had a chance to meet with the new director of the Chamber of Commerce, Ms. Jennifer Tavares, who we just appointed tonight to the Workforce Investment Board. And we heard a quarterly report from Bruce Stoff on the Convention and Visitors Bureau and basically tourism efforts. And if I can find the piece of paper that I had 30 seconds ago. Hotel occupancy has been pretty constant. The occupancy is 58%. Which hasn't changed. The average daily rate here is $146 per night, which is very high for the state. Room demand is up by 6.3%, and the room supply is actually up by 6.9%, so there's actually more supply. What we should keep in mind is that visitors bring a lot of money to our community. The year-to-date is about $24 million, and that's up 8.7% from last year. In general, things are going well. We really appreciate the tourists that come, and one of the reasons we appreciate it is they bring their revenue, we get their taxes, and then we can translate that into some wonderful programs, which we discussed next in terms of the budget for STPV and the proposed budget that we will be submitting to Joe. The committee heard the recommendation and asked some questions and gave its assent. Finally, we switched to discussion of TCAD. We heard their monthly report, and we heard a presentation by Martha Armstrong on the continuing work to develop the updated economic strategy for Tompkins County. As you probably know, we in the county do not have our own economic development
department or person. We've essentially ceded that operation to TCAD. They have they periodically come up with a plan, and the last one was 2006. It looks like this in hard copy. If you are interested in reading it, and I would actually encourage you to do that, go to the website and look under publications. It's the Economic Development Strategy 2006. We are currently figuring out what's going to be the next one for the next 10 years or so. Martha was at our committee just to basically share with us the outline and the thinking that's come to date. Bless you. We will be continuing that discussion and hopefully at some point bringing it back to the committee to see whether we are comfortable with the direction they are going. The decision ultimately is up to their board, but once again, because they do economic planning for us, I think we have a strong interest in what they come up with. So we are not at this point planning to have a meeting in September, but as I've mentioned before, we will be having a tour of the largest private employer in our county, BorgWarner, and that's scheduled for Friday, September 12th from 2 to 4. You are all invited. You should have gotten an invitation from Heather Filiberto. Just quick show of hands. How many people are thinking of maybe coming, going? So I'm seeing, okay, great. So if you haven't let Heather know that, please do. Are there any questions?
Carol?
Not a question, but just a little bit of a distinction. We didn't have time yesterday because we were spent a lot of time in discussion of other aspects of the strategic plan that Martha Armstrong was developing, but just to make the distinction that the county does do some economic development. We don't do industrial and manufacturing kind of development. They do that, but we do tourism development. We do workforce development. That all of that works together, agricultural, some of it, although there's a whole slew of organizations and agencies and county that's involved in that. And one of the things that's been so interesting about the Economic Development Committee is to be hearing the various reports and seeing how those various pieces fit together. So I just wanted to...
Thank you. And you remind me, Carol, that sort of parallel into this process of having the TCAD develop their strategy, our county planning department is, in fact, moving forward on their updated comprehensive plan, which will have an economic component. And ideally, those two will be in sync and very complementary. But there are some significant differences, and the committee talked about some of them, but... I would encourage you, once again, that exists from the county's website. You can sort of see how far they've gone, and if you are interested, look at that. And one of the key differences has to do, on the county's plan, a reference to encouraging the development of living wage jobs with benefits. And not as a mandate, but just say as an aspirational goal. And that is not currently part of the thinking of TCAD. So do we care about the nature of the kinds of jobs that get developed with the help of groups such as TCAD? That would be a subject of discussion, and I would encourage everybody to give that some thought.
Questions for Will?
I'm glad you mentioned that last part because I'm concerned that the legislature may take positions or support policies, and it would seem really unfortunate if TCAD did something counter to that. And I'm thinking back already about our many resolutions on fracking, and then our concern about the extension of life of coal plants by changing them to natural gas, and where that gas may come from, but the TCAD on its own motion made a big effort to support the conversion of a local coal plant to natural gas. And I'm uncomfortable when there's this tension between our economic development arm and the legislature.
Anything else?
That concludes my report. Thank you.
Nathan Shinagawa, Government Operations Committee.
Yes, the Government Operations Committee meeting will be August 26th at 5:30 here in the legislature chambers.
Any questions for Nathan? Anyone want to argue where it's going to be located? Old Library Committee, I'm pleased.
Sorry, Nate?
Go ahead, Dooley.
We're going to be revisiting the IT policy, as I recall.
And reviewing that, we'll also be looking at net neutrality that Dave talked about last time. And then we're going to talk again just to finalize the discussion on the privilege of the floor discussion. And then we have a bunch of other resolutions.
I wondered if there had been many responses to the request to have people send concerns about IT policy to Kathy Covert or to you.
No, Kathy, have you received anything? I have not.
There have been a couple that have been forwarded to ITS.
Thank you.
And we'll have the copies of those for the meeting?
Sure.
Yes. Okay. Great.
Dave, do you want to talk about broadband?
Yes, I would. Broadband committee met last evening, and we did adopt a resolution that will be brought to GEO for their approval on the 26th and hopefully September 2nd to the legislature.
Regarding what?
Net neutrality.
Net neutrality. Okay, thank you. Anything for Dave? Old Library Committee, please report. We had a really nice, interesting, effective public meeting on August 12th in these chambers. And it was at times standing room only. We opened it up. It was not an official meeting of the committee, but it was open for public comment, and we heard from 28 speakers, and I think there were about 70 people here. And we heard many different views about what should happen with the old library building. We had some talk, some discussion about with those folks about which particular responders to RFP they liked. Many liked the condominium concept. Others liked not taking down the building but rebuilding the current building. It was respectful, interesting, and informative. And if anyone else on the committee wants to comment on it, that was my opinion of it. I hate to do this to you, but I think we're going to have to, we've been trying to find a time to schedule our next meeting for the old library committee, and I think it's going to walk on your tour for Board Warner. Some of us may not be able to be there.
Oh, dear.
It may not be it'll start later after the tour, so people might be able to start the tour up there and have to come. But I regret that, but we tried two or three dates, and it's been real hard. We've got to have another meeting to talk about what we're hoping to see in the RFP based on the discussions that we had from the public, based on our own internal discussions, based on the Planning Advisory Board Committee's recommendations and those things, to try to move it along. Can I answer anybody's questions on that?
Yeah. What time are you thinking that the old library committee might be meeting?
3:00.
You could not make it later?
I don't know. We'll talk more about that.
I appreciate that very much.
But I know Kathy's been working diligently trying to come up with a time. Let's take 10 minutes. We'll come back and go into the Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee.
Nobody said anything about it.
All right. Thank you, folks. Let's move next to the report from the Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee. Carol Chalk is our chair.
Yeah. The committee will be meeting tomorrow, August 20th, at 12. For those following the times avidly of this committee, we are meeting at 12:30 at the Old Jail Conference Room. And people should bring their calendars, because we will be setting the it'll still be the same date. It'll still be the third Wednesdays, but as we have been, we'll be adjusting the times to fit the rest of the year. We should be able to do the next 4 months, and I believe that most of them will be able to continue at 12:30. We'll mention the comprehensive plan, and one of the things we'll be talking about and hearing more about are the many, many comments that that we received when we solicited input on the plan. The kinds of things people would like to see as quality of life issues here in Tompkins County. We got a lot of input, so we'll be hearing more about that. We'll be hearing something about the Way to Go program and stream corridors and other things. So it should be an interesting meeting. Look forward to seeing you there.
Questions for Carol? Charter review, we met, and we spent our time going through the Department of Assessment section of the charter. We got through that, and we'll meet again on September 3rd. And we will take up, well, it's still in transition. What are we going to do?
Personnel
committee, that's right. Not the committee, personnel section of the charter. Any questions? Let's go to budget. Jim Dennis is chair.
Thank you. We have four resolutions, one of which I added at the beginning of the meeting. The first one being a resolution relating to, let me read the title of it. It is 4982.
It's resolution F.
And F, it is a seeker, SC, State Environmental Quality Review Act resolution relating to facility and infrastructure improvements at Tompkins Cortland Community College, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave McKenna. Discussion. Julie?
I looked at the short environmental assessment form that's in the packet, and although part one is completed, part two isn't, and it's not signed either. So I'm wondering if there is a complete version somewhere.
Joe?
Yeah, we've followed the guidance of our bond counsel on this. So the first part of the form was completed largely to allow us to assess whether this does have any kind of an impact, and concluded that based on what the improvements are, and let me refresh you on what the improvements are. There's some parking field improvements. You probably, if you've been out there, you've seen that those are ongoing right now. There's some interior renovations of space, and there's also a small amount of space that's created by basically boxing in some areas under a cantilevered part of the building. Part of the building, it shoots out over a sidewalk, gets boxed in, and gets used for usable space in the future. So in looking at that, at the scope of the improvements, it was concluded that this is a type 2 action, so it really can stop where it is, and that's the way it has been approached and written into the resolution. Again, this is all following the guidance of bond counsel.
I didn't realize bond counsel did environmental assessment forms, too.
Well, they don't do environmental assessment forms, but they're very conscious of environmental issues and following the appropriate procedure, because if you don't, it can undermine the financing. So they're pretty scrupulous about this. So that's why we follow the guidance. And again, when you kind of visualize the improvements that are out there, I think you would agree it's a type 2. There's really no consequential impact.
I just am looking at the form, and there's nothing in here that says you can avoid part 2. So I'm surprised.
Could I
You know, it is a type 2-8 for an educational institution. If the improvement is less than 10,000 square feet, it's a type 2. This improvement is about 6,000 square feet. So they really didn't have to do that at all. They started doing that and along the way realized that it was only 6,000 square feet below the threshold. And the truth is they really, this is sort of overkill because they really didn't have to do it at all. All they really had to do was make sure it was a type 2 because it's less than 10,000 square feet. But they started out, I think, not really realizing that and got through part of the form before realizing that. So, you know, in my mind, they did actually considerably more than they really had to do. They really didn't have to do anything other than note that it was type 2-8.
Well, I would agree with that, Jonathan. It's the presence of this is what confuses me then. So I also don't understand where on this form it says 10,000 feet. Does it say it somewhere? Did I miss that?
It does refer to it in the resolution. I'm not sure whether there's any. I think what happened is, you know, in going through the form and in asking the questions going back and forth between the staff at TC3, they became aware that it wasn't, that it fell below the threshold. So it wasn't, I don't think the question is specifically, is it below 10,000 feet? It's just in answering, filling out these many boxes that in discussion with the staff that it came to their attention that it was less than 10,000 square feet.
Okay, thank you. Don't include it next time. It confuses me.
Okay, anything else? Are we ready to vote? Roll call vote, please. I'm told I don't need a roll call vote, and I won't demand one. How's that? All right, all those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous.
Thank you. Resolution G, it is a bond resolution authorizing the issuance of up to $3,525,000 in serial bonds and notes of the County of Tompkins, New York, to pay a portion of the cost of facility and infrastructure improvements at Tompkins Cortland Community College, and I would move that.
Is this the revised one?
Revised, Jim.
It is.
Okay, so that was the one that was in the packet. Is that correct, Jim?
It is.
The red folders, I apologize. Is there a second? Seconded by Peter Stein. Questions? Dooley Kiefer.
There's nothing on the revised resolution to indicate what is revised, so I guess it's just the dollar amount that's revised.
Joe?
It's both the dollar amount and it's the reference to the fact that this is on behalf, really, of both counties, this county and Cortland County. And if I could, would you like me just to explain what is happening here? The Budget Committee has been aware of the fact that Cortland County is still trying to decide the best way for Cortland County to approach this. And one of the options that has been talked about there is what we're doing tonight, which is to combine the financing of both counties. So the total sponsor share for this project is financed by this county, and then Cortland County's share of the annual debt service would then be paid over to us. That has not yet been concluded in Cortland County. They haven't decided which way to do it yet, whether they want to do it through a combined bond or they want to bond themselves individually, float their own issue for their share. So what we're doing tonight is suggesting that we should go ahead and have the authorization given for the combined bonding for the $3.5 million. And that would be the maximum authority we would be granted for this project. If Cortland County chooses later this month to proceed along that path of a joint bond, we're good to go. And that presumes that they will also formally sign off on an intermunicipal agreement, which will then bind them to make those annual debt reimbursements to us as that debt comes due. So it's really a two-part, the bond and then the intermunicipal agreement. So if Cortland County proceeds that way, if you approve this tonight and you approve the intermunicipal authority, we will be prepared to issue that debt. we'll be fine, and Rick will stay on the schedule. He needs to stay on to be able to get us into the market to borrow money for a number of projects that you've approved. If, on the other hand, Cortland decides not to do this, to just go on their own, borrow their share, contribute that way, Rick will still have time to adjust the amount of money he actually borrows. So in granting authority, you're granting him the maximum amount that he can borrow. But if we don't need to borrow for the Cortland share, there's still time for Rick to decide not to do that, and we wouldn't. So this really leaves us in a position of greatest latitude. Again, allows this project to be financed, allows the other bonds that we have already gotten your authority to do to go forward and to get into the market as quickly as we can.
I would also point out that the reason we're having to do it this way is because of the differences in their schedule of their meetings and our schedule of our meetings, and we really have to give Rick this authority. And they're not meeting until after this meeting, either their budget committee or their legislature. So we just couldn't coordinate it differently. Carol.
Yeah, so do we take on additional risk? Well, we do take on additional risk if we're the ones having to pay back the bonds. Will there be any additional agreement between us?
That's the
County.
The second resolution. That's the intermunicipal.
That's the one
agreement.
Jim added.
The answer is yes, there is a degree of additional risk. We've done this before. I should have said that when I explained this. This is not unprecedented. We've done it a few times before with Cortland. In the past, I don't know that we've had an underlying intermunicipal agreement. We're approaching it more cautiously this time. So this would have that underlying formalized agreement underneath it to ensure that they pay us when those payments come due.
Do we know anything about their, their ratio of debt to whatever you call it, the debt to the budget?
Well, one reason that they might go this way, and we don't know yet. They might go this way. Our credit rating is a AA1. It's really good. Theirs, I believe, is a single A1. So in terms of the cost to Cortland County, it's probably going to be higher if they go on their own. So that's their economic advantage.
And the other thing we need to remember here is that TC3 will be paying us for these principal payments from the chargebacks, their account. And they've committed that. We're still going to have to pay the interest on it. But as long as chargebacks hold up, most of this is going to be paid through that fund.
Thank you.
Jim Dennis.
I'm ready to vote on this. There's no more questions.
Okay. This does require a long form roll call. So I'm going to ask Kathy to read the roll, please.
Mr. Burbank?
Aye.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Mr. Shinagawa? Mr. Sigler?
Yes.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes. Does anyone want to change his or her vote? Please announce the vote.
12 ayes, 0 noes.
Go ahead, Jim.
Continuing Resolution H, a resolution authorizing the issuance pursuant to Section 90.10 of the local finance law refunding bonds of the County of Tompkins, New York, to be designated substantially public improvement refunding serial bonds and providing for other matters in relation thereto, and the payment of the bonds to be refunded thereby. And I would move that.
Seconded by Brian. Discussion. Julie Keeper.
I'm sorry. One change. Line 36. The word "by" is now the word "that." But I took it on my own not to destroy one more tree and print thousands of copies of a piece of paper.
Is that friendly? Brian is shaking his head yes. Okay. Dooley, did you have a question?
That's what I raised my hand for.
Okay. Are we ready? Carol Chalk.
So, Joe, can you tell me something about whether this is how the level of debt on this one compares to what it's replacing and what, both in terms of amount and expected rate?
I'll yield to Rick on this one.
Okay.
I have some details on that. It's about $21 million of bonds, give or take, when you, and it's for the 2005, 2007, 2010 bond series, all grouped together. I believe that the $21 million in bonds will be refunded with around $20 million worth of bonds, or 19 and a half. I can give you some details on what we use to predicate a sale like this to see if it's worth our while. The savings, based on last week financing plan, we did a financing plan to update the one that we did back in June, and the most current financing plan shows that we'd save $1,666,000 by doing this refinancing. That's about $92,500 each and every year in savings over a period of 18 years. The net present value savings, which is a financial marker that tells us whether this is a good deal to move into, is at 6.5% of the refund bonds. That's the net present value savings. We won't do a bond reissuance or bond refinancing unless it's greater than 4% net present value savings. So those are some of the factors that helped us determine whether it was worth our while to go through this much effort to refinance these three different series of bonds.
And are any of them bonds that are being served in that group that was being serviced by the IDA or TCAD from which they get fees? So they won't be losing?
No, like, no, it doesn't have anything to do with those.
Okay. Anybody we care about who will be losing fees from?
No, this is all general fund debt.
All
this
general
is all ours, and okay. We're just refinancing it at a better rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Peter Stein, then Dooley.
Better if we didn't have any discussion. Then I wouldn't even have thought to what to do. But what is it that allows us to make money by refinancing now? The interest rate is
dropping. Interest rate, yeah.
Is still dropping?
Compared to the time period in which they were purchased, yes. And we don't know by the time that we actually float the bonds in October and tonight if it's still going to, if that window of opportunity is still going to be there. So we have to test the market each and every week until we get to that point in time when the bonds actually, we pull the trigger and the bonds go for sale. Of course, if we don't have this level of savings, we can not do the purchase of the new bonds right up until the very last minute. You know, we can wait to that very last day and decide not to do it if it's not a favorable outcome. So I trust that compared from June to now, it's $100,000 better, the market, in savings than had we done it back then. So it seems to be moving in a direction to where it's even gotten sweeter. But we don't have a crystal ball, and anything can happen between now and mid-October.
So what do? Do you sit there watching the clock with your hand? It's 5 o'clock, and I don't know. Should we wait a little while? Or?
Well, I don't lose any sleep over it. I mean, it is what it is going to be on the day of the market, and I think we presented it to the legislatures knowing that we're at a very robust level of savings right now. Even if should the market turn a little bit one way or the other, I still think we're going to have some remarkable savings come October.
And I think that's a point. This isn't generating revenue. It's lessening an expense that we have.
I understand.
Julie?
I just wanted to let everybody know that Rick is a very patient man. I called him to ask lots of questions about what the different bonds were that were being refunded, and it was interesting to me to learn what was included. The 2005 ones were cooperative extensions, expansion. It was Food Net and Tompkins Community Action and TC3. And the same things keep recurring. The 2007 ones were 1.6 million roads and bridges, and 4 million TC3. And the more recent one included more, but it was, again, 4.5 million roads and bridges, again, TC3. The health department building and the health department building renovations and Ellis Hollow Road. So that's what's included. And I thought you all might be as interested as I was to learn that. And I noticed that although our financial policy lists banks we do business with, in the past it has not included other entities that we routinely do business with. So I was thinking that maybe the Budget Committee would consider the next time the finance policy comes around adding additional names of the entities that we work with to the policy.
Thank you, Dooley. Ready to vote? Roll call again, please.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Robinson?
Yes.
Mr. Shinagawa?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
Yes.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes. Anyone wish to change his or her vote? Please announce the vote.
Ayes 12, zero noes.
That passes. Jim?
Thank you. The addition that I added to the agenda is authorizing an intermunicipal agreement between Tompkins County and Cortland County regarding the payment of debt issued to support the TC3 campus master plan project, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Leslin. Discussion.
This was the question that Carol had. This is the response to that question, that the county certainly recognized that we needed to not put the county at risk, and this was the very best way that I believe our people have come up with to not put the county at risk as this debt payment process moves forward. So I would hope we could all support this.
Ready to vote. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous.
Thank you for that. Our next meeting is Monday, the 25th at 4 p.m. right here. The county administrator will be giving the budget to the whole ledge on September 2nd. September and October, the meetings start, and I will be requesting $20 apiece from each of you for September and October for those months to pay for food that might be consumed at those expanded budget committee meetings. With that, that ends my report. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Let's move on now to back to Brian Robinson for the rest of your report on Public Safety Committee.
Thanks, Mike. The Public Safety Committee did meet last Monday, the 11th. The agenda was pretty much filled up with things that you've already heard about, namely the grant that was accepted for the Department of Emergency Response. And the lion's share of it was obviously the report given by the ATI Task Force. I neglected to say anything when they were here, but obviously that committee did a great deal of work. It was formed under, let's say, difficult circumstances. I know Leslin and I were there even at the beginning when there were supposed to be two folks from the public. And just in reviewing those, if you remember, we kind of made a decision, the more folks from the public, the better. And it was expanded to four. We've still got a resolution that's got to come accepting, not adopting, but accepting the report from that task force. And I've had a lot of conversations with particularly Susie over this, and they, or I should say we, and the CJATI are looking forward to delving into a lot of this in subsequent meetings. But some of the things that did come out of this was probably things that we knew all along, and that is we here in Tompkins County do ATI programs quite well. That's not to say that a review shouldn't be done. It's almost unfortunate that you have to have a bit of controversy before you decide to go ahead and take a fresh look at things. But, you know, be that as it was, they did it. And there are some fresh ideas, and there are tweaks that can be made to present programs, and we're certainly looking forward to delving in and seeing what they can do. As they said before today, we're going to be seeing some of the immediate things in the form of ATIs, or I'm sorry, OTRs fairly soon here, and I think we can all guess what those are, but in my opinion, both facets of this were necessary things to do. The jail renovation project and this together. And we will move forward.
Thank you, Brian. Questions? Peter Stein, then Dooley Kiefer.
I was reading in the paper the other day about grants that department or whether it's the Army or the Department of Defense or who are giving to local police forces where they're giving them APCs and tanks and drones and things like that, sophisticated modern weapons that are used in warfare. Are we taking part in any of that, do you know, or?
Not that I'm aware of, no. No, I haven't heard anything of that sort. It'd be kind of neat to get a drone to play with, but no.
You had to go there, didn't you?
No. Well, I've got Julie next, then Carol.
The thing that struck me when I heard the ATI group report again today is that some of the things that they really think would be important require space in the jail, and there isn't any space that I can see, and I don't really know how we're going to manage that, and I hope that you have some ideas for our committee.
Well, it's not so much if I personally do. It's my recollection that and we're going back to last fall, where we were talking about the different phases of things that were going on at the facility, that there was, and you're going to have to help me out with this, Joe, that there was funding in place already to do kind of a feasibility type study on not the jail part, but
corrections.
Not corrections, but other space within the jail, and that feasibility study is being generated just for program space, and we still don't know at this point whether we're going to be able to do something there or not. But in answer to your question, yes, we recognize that as a need and are certainly looking for ways to accommodate that.
When I said corrections, I meant civil. It was the civil side.
Okay. Yeah. Or patrol or, you know, whatever. Let's call it the west side of that building. But, Joe, can you?
Well, I heard the additional space thing come up a couple of times in the presentation. I think for folks who are tracking this conversation, there are no plans to add space. I think what they were saying was there are certain limitations on what we can do because there's only so much space at the jail. So what we had talked about earlier was if the sheriff ever moved out of that facility and was able to free up space, how could you reprogram that space? So we did spend a couple of dollars, and we were very open about it, and everybody knows that, as a part of the Labella plan to look at how that might work. But, again, as we sit, to be really clear, there is no plan to expand, add space, repurpose, or anything else at this point.
True. But the concept is certainly on the radar. I mean, that we can say.
Let's see. Carol's next, then I've got Will.
Yeah, I just wanted to respond a bit to the question that Peter asked, because I think that, you know, we don't get a lot of grant money for our Department of Public Safety. You know, we pay most of it locally, but to the extent that we do get money, the Department of Homeland Security if we look back at all the various resolutions where we've accepted money, most of it has come from this program that has to do with funding activities that were meant to protect us against sort of international threats. So if you look back, did we recently get money for, and much of that equipment, not just there, but in other departments, the internet itself. I mean, much of the equipment that we use was designed for military purposes, to start with night vision goggles. And my favorite was the motion detected video surveillance system. And I mean, we can look back at our grants and find an awful lot of examples of equipment that was developed for wartime and international terrorism kinds of activities. And the issue that the reason that I'm always pulling those off of the consent agenda is so that we'll notice. And so that we'll be aware, and I think the issue is not necessarily, you know, where was it developed and where was it first used. There's a new issue that they're now have this surplus equipment, SWAT vehicles and things like that. But it's a question of, is there a policy for its use? So that when audio surveillance equipment was developed.
Can Brian respond to that question?
Yeah, can I finish making the point? So when audio surveillance equipment was developed, which was developed for, you know, again, to in the early part of, you know, the 20th century to listen in on international spies, there was policy developed where you had to go to a court to decide to use the stuff. And the issue that I would hope that we would continue to confront is, you know, if we're going to use equipment, have we decided when and how we're going to use it? And if we're doing crowd control, have we decided how we'd like to see that happen as policy rather than just on the fly out in the field.
Brian, can you respond to that before I go to the next person?
Yeah, I'll try. I thought it started out as a funding question, and I think what you're referring to is, first off, to my knowledge anyway, you don't get surplus military equipment given to you. You will get a grant, a Homeland Security grant, which is money. It's not equipment. It's money. You've got to remember that some of the things you mentioned, although they were developed for warfare, there actually are practical uses locally for things like you mentioned night vision goggles. You can imagine, you're looking for a missing child in the pitch dark. You might want people that have night vision goggles. It has nothing to do with warfare. But it's useful. The last Homeland Security grant was tied to, I think it was the license plate readers. Doesn't have a thing to do with warfare. I mean, it's, you know, the war on suspended vehicles or drivers or something like that. But as far as the policy, anytime you get a piece of equipment other than the run-of-the-mill stuff, it is incumbent on, and it's not just the sheriff's office, it's anybody. You know, if you get equipment, you should have already in place a policy pertaining to its use. And I would venture to guess, at least I hope, that any time you get a piece of equipment such as what you're referring to, there is a corresponding policy on where and when and who, based on training, can use that equipment.
Yeah, no, that's my point exactly, that, you know, looking for a missing child in the dark is very different from, you know, going into people's backyards and without suspicion and watching what they do in their backyards. Or a license plate reader, you know, it's one thing to read the license plate of somebody who has done something wrong. To me, going with a license plate reader and tracking the location of every parked car along the side of the road, so that, you know, to me, that's a more of an invasion of my personal privacy than I really would like to see. So it's the policy about when we'll use them, but that's something that would be great to have a conversation about.
That sounds like committee discussion. Will, you're next.
Perfect. Thank you, Mike. And I want to respond to both points, or both threads here. I think there has been a growing national awareness of the militarization of local law enforcement, and part of it has been sort of fueled by the availability of this equipment that's coming, that is surplus. There's money, grants to be had they can got. So, and this became just painfully clear in the early days of the events out in Ferguson, Missouri, where they had a mine-resistant armed troop carrier going into the town and essentially escalating what, you know, what was a tragic situation and a difficult thing, but essentially coming up with a response that I think arguably made the situation worse, and people responded. And I think it's entirely appropriate for us to be taking a very hard look at this equipment and see, is that something really appropriate to our community? Do we want it? How would it be used? So I'm very supportive of Carol's concern. As to the question of space, I would remind us that we went through a long period of trying to consider various iterations, and we finally ended up with an outdoor recreation area that will allow us to be out of there most of the days and have programs out there, thus freeing up, I think, for most of the time, the sort of multipurpose room that we had thought might have to be used much more as a backup for recreation. So there is potentially space. I hope that the committee will work with the Sheriff's Lansing and try to see if we can't get some more programming there. So.
Leslie.
I'm going to ditto the last comment that Will made about the space. It made me raise my eyebrows to hear about that, because it's one of the things as we were talking with people who were coming here and talking about what are things we could be doing. Having programming space was a priority. So I would hope that we will seriously make this a priority if we're talking about trying to help people get back into the community, not return to jail, providing opportunities for them to not be sitting there twiddling their thumbs, as someone said earlier, that we will make it a priority to find space in the jail for programming. Too often, the space gets taken away that's for programming. We've seen that happen already. We were just in public safety talking about a program that no one seemed to know what happened to it. It was supposed to be happening. So I just want to, it made me a little concerned to hear that, and I just wanted to put that out there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brian. Leslin?
Oh, wait a minute. Sorry. The next meeting is September 8th, and I had a note left on my desk that the meeting after that, so committee members can be thinking about this, happens to fall on Columbus Day, which is closed, so we're going to have to do something different there. But okay. That's it.
Thank you. Let's go to Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. Leslin McBean Claiborne is our chair.
Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee will meet on August 27th at the old jail. We had a Skype, is that what you call it? Whatever the thing is where people show up on the TV screen, they're in a different place.
Adding yes up
here. All right. interview of two finalist vendors for the RFP. And we are now at the place where we're trying to negotiate with one of those. One clearly knew what it is they were doing, what we were asking for, and sort of fit the bill for what we're looking for. And so we're in a process through Jackie Kipola of talking to that vendor about pricing and what we can afford for a climate survey. What that vendor had provided to us was an entire package of services that they can provide to the county for issues dealing with diversity and inclusion from a survey on up to implementation. And so we're trying to get that parceled out so we can focus on the one thing we said we will be doing, which is taking the pulse of our county workforce to see where we are, how we're doing relative to diversity and inclusion. So we're proceeding steadily along with that and hope to hear back soon.
Thank you, Leslin. Questions? Minutes of August 5th. Someone want to move them?
Move.
Will, seconded by Mike, I think it was. Discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Those opposed? One opposed. Any unfinished business? Dooley?
I forgot to ask, so I'm asking now that Frank Krupa's remarks with respect to changes to Resolution E, the local law, be included in the minutes.
Okay. Are we ready to adjourn?
Yes.
Motion by Brian, seconded by Jim. All in favor? We are adjourned. Thank you to Kathy Covert, Karen Fuller, and Marsha Lynch for always being here and getting us through these minutes and through these meetings, I should say.